Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Signs with Amy Jurevich. Elon Musk's time in the Trump administration has come to an end. Battles with Harvard, the acceptance of an airplane from a foreign government, and back and forth on tariffs have given the president a new nickname as well. The Trump administration continues to upend American institutions beyond the federal government, and joining us today to talk about national politics is Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Welcome back to All Sides, Ken.
Thank you, Amy.
So I wanted to start with the big, beautiful bill. After spending almost $300 million to return Donald Trump to the White House, Elon Musk's time in Washington has come to an end. But now he's done an about-face. He's criticizing President Trump's big, beautiful bill.
You know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not doesn't decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing. I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful, but I don't know if it can be both.
All right, so Ken, what do you think of Musk's change in tone regarding the Trump administration and the GOP? And I also think that we're having some interference on Zoom from our newsroom. So someone in the newsroom actually has their volume up on Zoom. So that's what that is. Okay, they're gone. All right.
Can we deport them to Guatemala?
I don't think we're allowed to. Well, maybe we're allowed to do that. We'll see what the Supreme Court says. Okay, so backing up, you could hear Elon Musk there kind of making a joke that a bill can be big and also a bill can be beautiful, but it can't be both. So what do you think of Musk's change in tone regarding the Trump administration and this bill and just basically like the second he left DOGE, now he's criticizing?
Well, if the purpose of DOGE was to reduce the federal deficit and, of course, to, you know, save all this money, the fact that this big, beautiful bill would increase the deficit by $2.4 trillion is exactly what Musk was opposing from the beginning. Now, of course, there's something also in the bill that ends the financial perks you get by owning electric cars. And of course, Musk didn't like that either. But what's so fascinating about this is that now he's threatening to spend money against the Republicans, and almost every Republican in the House voted for it, except for two. But and now we're watching, going to see what happens in the Senate. But Musk is threatening to spend money against the reelection of all these Republicans if they're going to vote for it in the final version. And these Republicans who are so terrified of Donald Trump to begin with, now they're terrified of the wallet, you know, the bank book of Elon Musk. So they don't know where to go. But ultimately, I mean, even Donald Trump saying, "Well, gee, I didn't realize it increased the deficit like this, and maybe this is not a beautiful bill after all." So they're all hoping, everybody's hoping, at least the Republicans are hoping, that the Republicans will somehow fix it in the Senate, and so everybody, including Elon Musk, and especially Elon Musk, can be happy.
What do you think Elon Musk's lasting impact will be? His time with DOGE, what will we remember about this, what was it, 4 or 5 month period?
Well, aside for bringing back Mike Myers on Saturday Night Live, I mean, I think what people remember about him is that he came in an unelected person who spent, you know, millions and millions of dollars to elect Donald Trump, as you said in your intro, and they just fired thousands and thousands of federal employees that had just given their whole lives to their careers, non-political jobs, but they just fired them and got rid of it, and people just flabbergasted. So I think, I mean, his numbers are down. The Tesla stock numbers are down. I have a friend who has a bumper sticker on her Tesla and just said, "I bought this before Elon was crazy," or something like that. But I mean, basically, he's just, you know, he's one of the most unpopular people in the country, and yet he waged so much power, so much influence with Donald Trump.
Now, the big, beautiful bill carrying President Trump's domestic agenda narrowly made it through the House. Some of the things it would do are gut Medicaid, gut food stamps, roll back clean energy efforts, shut down the Department of Education, cut pensions for federal workers. For the next 10 years, state governments could not legislate or regulate AI in any way, shape or form. What is your reaction to this bill overall, but also the fact that it passed the House by such a narrow margin? Were you expecting that?
Well, I mean, look, Republicans know that if they stand up to Donald Trump, they will be challenged. And just like Elon Musk is challenging now, they'll be challenged in the primaries in 2026. And they're terrified. I've never seen, I think of all the Republican presidents in the past, Richard Nixon, who had two Supreme Court justices where 17 Republican senators and the other one, 13 Republican senators voted against him. I mean, the thought of, you know, back in the past, Republican lawmakers had a conscience and they knew exactly what would be best for their states and their reelection, and they decided to vote accordingly. But now everybody is so terrified of Donald Trump about what retribution he could bring to them that they vote, you know, even against their own interest to do it. I mean, just watching these senators and congressmen trying to come up with reasons for their vote, and then you go into these town hall meetings and they're just pilloried by the folks, say, look, you don't even know what you're doing. This is terrible for us. And they're just torn between the desire to get reelected and the desire to please Donald Trump.
Now, the bill is wide ranging. It's over 1,100 pages, but one line in it takes away the ability of courts to enforce contempt orders against federal officials. How do you see that reshaping checks and balances here in our country?
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah. I mean, you know, once upon a time, there was a check on the executive branch, and that was either Congress, you know, the legislative branch, or the judiciary. And we knew something was up early when Vice President Biden said, look, these courts should have no bearing on what we do in the executive. They have no say, and they have no right to stop us, which is so remarkable. And to put this in writing and to put this as part of a bill is just, you know, I mean, the fact is the Supreme Court is mostly in Donald Trump's corner anyway. They voted, they decided that whatever he did as president, it cannot be challenged. I mean, you can't arrest him or charge him with crimes if he did it in the pursuit of his job as president. So with the judiciary, and even when the judges stand up to Donald Trump, as we've seen with some of the deportation rulings, the White House just says, we don't care. So, you're not going to impeach somebody with a Republican Congress. Now, even if the Democrats win the House in 2026, which I think they will, so maybe they impeach Trump, but so what? The Senate, two-thirds of the Senate is not going to convict him and remove him from office. So he's really impenetrable, and the only way to change anything is, you know, through at the election box. And who knows how free and fair that'll be when the next presidential election comes up in 2028.
Now, related to the big, beautiful bill, some Republicans, including Marjorie Taylor Greene and Mike Flood, are now admitting they didn't know everything that was in the bill. Is this unique to this term, or do lawmakers often, I mean, in history, do lawmakers often not know what's in giant bills?
True. Now, that's absolutely true. You can't single this bill out. A lot of times they'll put gigantic, you know, multiple pages of language that they don't read. And they suddenly said, oh, I didn't know this was in the bill. But this is remarkable because aside from everything Donald Trump has been doing all along, which has been executive orders, I mean, Congress hasn't done anything. And then when they do something, they wrap everything together in one gigantic hodgepodge of a bill, you know, thousands of pages. Of course, nobody's going to read it. But this is a very odd way of governing. I mean, one, they don't pass anything because Trump is busy doing his executive orders. And two, when they do pass something, it's, you know, so many thousands of pages that nobody reads, nobody has time to read. And then only later when people, you know, go through it, they say, oh, I didn't know that was in it.
Now, I'm being told that there's a ruling that just came down from the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure if you've been following this, Ken, but the Supreme Court just ruled in a unanimous decision To say that it's easier to claim reverse discrimination. This case involves a straight woman who worked at the Ohio Department of Youth Services who was claiming discrimination, but she's not a part of a minority population. Are you familiar with this case?
I'm not. It came down today?
Yes, that's what I'm being told right now. So
I did not know that, but it just seems like that the people, according to the Trump administration, the people who are being discriminated against are white people, not people of color, not the people who are being deported to, you know, South Sudan and El Salvador and Venezuela and things like that. It's the white people. So the fact, which is remarkable about this ban, this so-called Muslim ban 2.0 that he just put through, where, you know, people from other countries that with oppressive governments cannot come to the U.S. So a lot of these people from Afghanistan and Libya and all these places cannot come here. But Donald Trump also says that South Africa is a oppressive country. So but he's allowing all the white people, the white Afrikaners, to come to this country because they're being discriminated. It's interesting that it's always white people, it's always straight people who are being discriminated against, not the gays, not the women, not the blacks, not the Latinos.
Well, stay with NPR later today. We'll have more information on this reverse discrimination case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, but it does relate to an Ohio case. So it originated in Ohio, and knowing how long it takes for some things to get through the Supreme Court, I'm guessing that this case came about probably prior to Trump taking office. But we'll have more information on that. Stay with 89.7 NPR News to learn more about that case. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics with Ken Rudin, the host of the Political Junkie podcast. And I wanted to talk for a minute about the Senate. Republican senators, notably Rand Paul, are speaking out against Trump's big, beautiful bill, saying it will increase the deficit. So do you think that more GOP senators are going to give it a try, speaking out against Trump, maybe rewriting this bill a little bit?
Well, certainly they're going to rewrite it in the Senate, and they probably have Elon Musk's anger to back them up. But Rand Paul has a history of complaining about how the Constitution is being changed or altered or violated, and how the budget is being the budget is out of control. And at the end, he always votes for it. So Rand Paul does have a history of speaking out and complaining and talking about constitutional principles, and then he winds up voting for it. But it is interesting. You are seeing somebody like Rand Paul. Now, there are not many of them. For the most part, everybody's still backing Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, and Donald Trump with everything they decide to do. But every now and then, you know, you'll get a Rand Paul. Now, we've seen people in the past who have spoken out, the Liz Cheneys, the Adam Kinzingers, the Ben Sasses from Nebraska, even Rob Portman of Ohio, but they're all no longer in office. So it's one thing to complain, and it's another thing to just, you know, leave politics altogether because of fear of defeat. Rand Paul is gutsy, and it's interesting that Kentucky, that has Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, two senators who, at least in the recent times, have spoken out against Donald Trump. Of course, Mitch McConnell did everything that Trump wanted for all these years, but lately he's been kind of more of a dissident. But it's interesting that both Paul and McConnell come from the same state. We'll see if those numbers increase as we get closer to the election.
I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about tariffs. The whole back and forth on tariffs recently produced a new nickname for President Trump. The name was given by, it was basically coined by the Financial Times' Robert Armstrong, who is calling him a TACO, T-A-C-O, standing for Trump Always Chickens Out. What do you make of this new nickname, calling President Trump Taco?
Well, you know, Trump hates it because when the reporter brought it up at the White House press conference, he said, "That's a nasty question. How dare you ask that question?" I mean, you know, he loves the questions where a reporter will say, "Mr. Trump, how do you lose all this weight and why do you look so handsome?" And then he'll say, "Oh, I love these questions." But when somebody will ask him something that he doesn't like, he'll say, "It's nasty and how dare you do this?" But it's true. That's exactly what he does. Taco is exactly what he does. He alters it all the time, when the heat gets too high, he changes his mind. So when he raises the tariffs and then the stock market takes a deep beating, he says, "Uh-oh, I'm kind of in trouble. People are losing their life savings. So I'll temporarily suspend it." And then everybody comes back, the stock markets come back, and he says, "See, I told you, I'm a, you know, everything is going out going really well." It's remarkable. There's no. The whole thing is not about real economics. It's not about philosophy. It's about dealing. Donald Trump loves to deal. And when he comes up with these crazy numbers against Britain and France and Germany and China, he always comes up with a number that's much larger than anyone thinks that the other country will abide by. And then he'll say, okay, let's negotiate. Now, everybody knows that that's the game he's playing. And because of that, I think countries are less bowled over by Trump's bluffs than they had been in the past. And he just resents that. So, but Taco is a perfect name because that's what he does. He just, you know, he supports it until he doesn't.
Now, when Trump was visibly offended by the reporter who asked him if he was chickening out, he called it negotiating. That's what he's doing.
That's what he does, exactly, and the art of the deal. But it's really the art of the, you know, I don't know what art I would call it. But I mean, he thinks of himself as an amazing businessman who can cow and force, you know, other countries to bend to his will. But when it doesn't happen that way, he just remarks and with such terror as he did with that reporter. But he thinks he's a great businessman. A lot of countries see through what he's doing, and just we'll see how long it lasts. But it's just interesting that last time he raised it and the stock market was falling, and then suddenly he lowered the tariffs just at a time when Marjorie Taylor Greene and other members of Congress seemed to buy stocks at the perfect time, and suddenly she made a fortune because of the rise in the stock market. Let's see if there's any investigation into kind of stock manipulation that may be going on when he raises and then lowers the tariffs.
Coming up, we're going to continue to talk about national politics with Ken Rudin, and we'll talk about that very fancy plane from a very not American country. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. There are commentators and politicians alike who say that Donald Trump and his family have been using the White House for personal financial gain. Examples they have cited include acceptance of a plane from Qatar, a dining with top investors in cryptocurrency projects, pardoning predominant Republicans who have donated millions to his reelection campaign. We're talking national politics this hour with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. And Ken, let's start with that plane. After complaining about Air Force One, Donald Trump has accepted a $400 million plane from Qatar. And this is what he had to say about the gift.
If we can get a 747 as a contribution to our Defense Department to use during a couple of years while they're building the other ones, I think that was a very nice gesture. Now, I could be a stupid person and say, oh, no, we don't want a free plane. We give free things out. We'll take one, too.
So what do you think? Is it a free plane? There's no such thing as a free lunch, right?
Exactly. I mean, I mean, the fact that the lining of his pockets, the lining of the Trump family's pockets, especially after hearing for years and years about the Biden crime family, is just astounding. This plane, of course, he says, well, I could be, you know, I could be stupid and not take it. You could also be honest and not take it. The mm-hmm. fact is that the gifts that have been given to this president, I mean, there was an article in the New York Times a week or so ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, that talked about when Hillary Clinton made $100,000 in cattle futures 12 years before Bill Clinton was elected president. Then they ran her through the, you know, the ring about this, and there were hearings and saying about Clinton corruption, and this is $100,000. Jeff Bezos is giving, you know, Melania $28 million for a documentary. The cryptocurrency that are going into the Trump family pockets. And this plane, he says, well, it's a gift to the Defense Department. Nobody thinks it's a gift to the Defense Department. It's a gift to Donald Trump, that people will assume that after his presidency, assuming he ever leaves the White House, that he'll be able to use for his personal gain, personal convenience. It's just remarkable. I mean, have other presidents taken advantage of things like this? Yes, but to the extent of millions and millions and millions of dollars, and there's no correction. There's nobody standing over saying, well, you know, this may not be right. All these agencies whose job is to make sure that, you know, corruption laws are followed, they've all been defanged. And so he just does what he wants, and nobody speaks out against it, certainly nobody on the Republican Party.
Now, I mean, have there been gifts from foreign countries to past presidents? Maybe nothing quite as big as a plane, but I'm sure there have been. Statues.
Well, they have been.
Paintings. The Statue of Liberty, right? The Statue of Liberty. That was.
I know. I love when they mention that. Yeah, that was definitely a gift to the president. But everything is about, you know, I used to think that he wanted to run for president just so he can stay out of prison, because obviously he's not going to go to prison if he's elected to the presidency. But it's also a way to make just millions and millions of dollars, which has always been his thing. He always had to talk about how much money he made. And the fact that I think in the first 4 months of his presidency, his net worth is just, you know, I don't know if it's quadrupled, it couldn't have done that, but it's certainly raised tremendously. And this is what he does. And everybody just says, oh my God, he's getting away with this. And the truth is, he is getting away with it, because who's stopping him? Not a Supreme Court, not any kind of agency that is questioning the ethics of this.
Now, you mentioned this earlier. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court granted presidents broad immunity. Do some of President Trump's actions also seem to benefit him personally because of this immunity? Because I'm thinking specifically of those pardons of campaign donors and those dinners with the cryptocurrency investors. Can he do this because of the Supreme Court decision?
Look, all presidents have done pardons. The famous Bill Clinton pardon of some kind of convicted swindler whose wife gave a lot of money to Bill Clinton, and Clinton pardoned him on the way out of office. So other presidents have done this. But I mean, it's just, you see this drug guy. Trump keeps talking about how Biden let all these drug criminals roam free in this country. And yet somebody who was serving, I don't know if it was a life sentence or 30-year sentence for peddling drugs and dealing with drugs and things like that, all these different kind of drugs, he just pardoned him. And the guy whose mother just gave $1 million, I mean, he was a swindler who was in office. He had a $4 million fine and was going to go through a prison sentence. And then he gave him an unconditional pardon because his mother, you know, contributed $1 million to the Trump, you know, campaign or whatever. It's shameless. And it's still shocking, even though it happened over and over again. I don't know when the shock will wear off, but the fact is, nothing changes, nothing stops him. And I don't know, I mean, obviously Democrats can't call for hearings because they're in the minority. We'll see what happens after 2026.
But it's not just the Trump administration. I would think if you ask, you know, some average Americans, they would just think this is how business is done in politics. Everyone's corrupt.
That's exactly what Trump was doing very effectively by talking about the Biden crime family, and he'll talk about, look, what Hunter Biden did to get his job with the oil deal in Ukraine. Obviously, he did it with the influence of his father. I mean, there's no question that by focusing on Biden, it almost lets Trump off the hook. Well, like as a matter of fact, when Trump did some of those pardons the other day or a week or so ago, he said, well, look what Trump did with Hunter Biden. So he always points to what Joe Biden has done to give him excuses for things like lining his pockets or doing pardons.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics this hour with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Since returning to office, President Trump has entered into fights with higher education, most notably Harvard, and also with cultural institutions like the Kennedy Center and the Smithsonian. What do you think he's hoping to accomplish with some of these things whenever it comes to, when you think about something like changing the Smithsonian?
Well, I mean, it's with everything. It's everything that has anything to do with culture or DEI or LGBTQ or anything like that, that is just not the way he sees in America. I mean, that's been Trump's thing from day one, that it's just a white Western European, like he said the other day, why can't they all come from Finland or Norway? And why are they coming from, Africa or South America, things like that. So he always has a thing about the kind of culture he sees in America. And that's what he feels about. Look what happened this week, that they just renamed naval ships. I mean, this month is Pride Week. This is Pride Month, and June is Pride Month. And yet the Justice Department took off the name of Harvey Milk from a naval carrier. They took off the name Thurgood Marshall, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Harriet Tubman. And I'm looking at this list, that this is a list of just coincidentally, a gay American, an African American, and two women, and one African American woman. But so this is what, this is how they see America. It's just not gay, not diversified, not instead of priding itself on the accomplishments of disadvantaged people, he just wants it back. He wants basically the Afrikaners of the world to rule the United States, and he's doing everything in his power to do that. And that includes like Harvard, which he just said this week that he's banning into them from accepting international students, things like that. I mean, this is what he does. And it's, I mean, is it racist? Is it not racist? It's just remarkable. And it's just one list after another, after another. And I think I read somewhere that a lot of people say, well, you know something, they've seen so much of it, and nothing phases them anymore.
You used the word flabbergasted earlier. I love any instance when I can use the word flabbergasted.
They're also, what's the word I want? That they've seen it so many times. It's going on and on, and they're just immune from disappointment or shock or surprise anymore. I don't know if that's the right word either, but.
One of my producers says immune. The other producer says, are you searching for the word outrage fatigue? I don't know.
Well, fatigue is the right word too, yeah. But I think numb is the word I want. Numb. Because that's the word I wanted. Because everything.
A simple word.
Well, no, it's what it is, because it's one story after another, after another. I mean, we've spent a half hour on the show alone talking about everything he's done, or at least a lot of the things he's done. And a lot of people aren't paying attention anymore. I know so many people who stop reading newspapers, who stop watching the news, because they're just so, as you said, fatigued and numb.
Yeah. So I know a lot of people who had to get rid of all push notifications on their phone because they just, every time they pick up their phone, it can't be breaking news.
The only thing they should keep on is WOSU, right?
Yeah, WOSU. Yeah. That's the only push notifications you need.
Exactly.
Um, I,
I wanted to talk a little bit about things happening with the cabinet. This week, Trump's head of FEMA admitted he didn't know what a that there was a hurricane season. Now, he said he was joking, but that was arguably a weird joke to make, I guess.
That's it. Every time he says something, he says, oh, I was being sarcastic. Trump says that all the time. Mm-hmm. I was being sarcastic, you know, about I would end the Ukraine-Russian war within 24 hours. And he said it a million times during the campaign. And now when they're bringing it up, he said, oh, I was just being sarcastic. I mean,
24 hours in air quotes, 24 hours. Like, yes,
exactly.
Just quickly.
And then and the other, the case about who was it? Who was it? Christy Noem, who had no idea the definition of habeas corpus. She had it completely backwards. And when Maggie Hassan and the other senators quizzed her about it, it was humiliating to see somebody in the cabinet like Christy Noem, whose, you know, qualifications obviously was killing dogs and goats to get to the cabinet. But I mean, but, you know, the fact that she had no idea what habeas corpus was and is, and when her cabinet is responsible for, you know, obeying these constitutional guarantees, it's just remarkable how unprepared, how unknowledgeable, and ill-fitted this cabinet is. But look, the Republicans went through. They confirmed them. I mean, with one or two exceptions, every Republican stayed in line. Hegseth was the closest. It was 51-50. It was Vice President Vance who broke a tie. But other than that, they passed everyone. There was not one member of the cabinet who was not confirmed.
Now, other members of the cabinet have also made embarrassing gaffes. The Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, called AI A1, like the steak sauce. And then Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. submitted a report written by AI with fake citations. I have to think that slips of the tongue or, you know, making mistakes. Every administration has their people in the cabinet who do these things, but are we seeing more?
Don't let yourself say, well, everybody does.
Everybody makes a mistake.
And other presidents have lined their pocket. This is remarkable. This is unprecedented, a word we've said on the show a million times. I'm going to protect you from saying this because I know you don't believe it, and I know nobody believes it. But we've never, ever seen an administration on everything we've talked about, any administration behaving like this.
And it's not just members of the cabinet. Iowa Senator Joni Ernst had a town hall where she made a misstep about saying that everyone will eventually die. But then she made her apology in a cemetery, so that was viewed by a further misstep.
And it was a fake. It was a fake apology. Mm-hmm. She went on and started talking about the fairy, you know, the fairy monsters or the fairy, whatever it was. I mean, she was sarcastic with her apology. And she's up for re-election next year. But she also was the one who was a tooth fairy, right? Exactly. But she also was the one who was hesitating about voting for Pete Hegseth because she, a former military officer, was raped in her career, and Hegseth made light of women who have been abused and raped in the military, and she considered voting against her. And then everybody flooded, all the Trumpers flooded her states with ads saying, "You vote against Hegseth, you'll be destroyed in the primary." And then suddenly she just snap to it and backs the administration in anything they do. It's
remarkable, right?
Right.
Coming up, we're going to continue talking about national politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. We're going to talk a little bit about former President Joe Biden, about his cancer diagnosis, and a new book that is out related to Joe Biden's time in office. That is When All Sides with the Political Junkie continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking about national politics with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Former President Joe Biden has been out of office since January. However, he was still garnering headlines. And since his cancer diagnosis, he's not been seeking the spotlight. CNN anchor Jake Tapert has been getting some backlash for his recent book written with Alex Thompson of The Atlantic on how people around President Biden kept him hidden from public. Ken, what do you make of the media attention surrounding Biden's cancer diagnosis, coupled with the timing of when this book came out?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think Thompson is with Axios, not at the
Atlantic. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's fascinating. First of all, you know that the cancer diagnosis is bad because Donald Trump said he has stage 9 cancer. That's what Donald Trump said. He said that Joe Biden has stage 9 cancer. But then he also said, I can't feel sorry for him because he's hurt for so many people. This guy is so devoid of compassion and decency that I just can't go crazy. But it's a fascinating book. Tapper's book is called The Original Sin, that talked about a cover-up, and basically that the Democratic Party, the White House, Joe Biden himself, they all covered up the infirmities, the mental acuity questions of Joe Biden. And this, we've known for a long time, I mean, you could just see Joe Biden in action, that he had some, he was aging. Look, we knew it when he was running in 2020, he had gaps. And I think one of the reasons, one of the things that protected him was it was a COVID election. And as the Biden people said, we hid him in the basement for a long time. So there's some truth to that. But the thought of a cover-up, by the way, I would recommend a better book. It's called Uncharted by Chris Whipple. Has a much better, even-handed story of what it was. But the fact is that Joe Biden was not in a good position to run for re-election. He was forgetting things. He was forgetting names. Now, we could also talk about what Donald Trump has done with forgetting names. But again, now nobody's writing a book about that. And maybe one day Jake Tapper will write a book about that. But the point is that there were legitimate questions about Joe Biden that I don't know if it started in 2015 when Beau Biden died, when 2023 when Hunter Biden was had all those gun and drug charges against him, whatever it was, he was 82 years old and not with it. And the question is why. Why did they wait until the June 27th debate, where Joe Biden clearly was completely out of it, and let Donald Trump's crazy pronouncements rule the day because Biden was clueless, basically, about what was going on, especially his lines about I ended Medicare or something like that, and Donald Trump loved that. The fact is that I wonder about Joe Biden's legacy, because in his first 2 years of his presidency, he accomplished almost more than anybody could have imagined with barely a majority in Congress, and yet he got so much done, and a remarkable amount done. But ultimately, by deciding to run again, by fighting off those in the Democratic Party, the Nancy Pelosi's, the Barack Obama's, the Chuck Schumer's, even the George Clooney's of the world, to keep him from running again. My fear, my sadness about this whole thing, and I think it is a tremendous tragedy, is that Joe Biden's legacy might be that he brought Donald Trump back to power, because had he dropped out early, had he been a pathway, his election in 2020 would be a pathway to a new generation. Had he stuck with that, then the Democrats could have had a much livelier, better focused, better campaign, and I think that would have made a big difference. But Biden insisted on it. Jill Biden insisted on it. They wanted him to run. He felt that only he could beat Donald Trump. And we saw what the result is. I mean, I thought Kamala Harris ran a great campaign. I really do. I thought she had a great convention. I thought she wiped the floor with Trump and the cat eating the cats and dogs during the debate. I mean, I thought she was just great. But ultimately, she only had 100-some-odd days to run a campaign. A lot of people didn't like her, didn't trust her, didn't feel that she was completely vetted enough. So the book is, and this is a long way of saying that I think that there's truth to the book in that he should not have been running. There were problems, whether it was a concerted effort to keep the truth from the American people. I question that because a lot of people said that when Biden was dealing with foreign leaders and foreign crises, he was up for it. He was up for it. I think one of the problems also was that the Democrats did so well in the 2022 midterms that Biden said, you know something, it's because of me, and I think I deserve to run again. But as it turns out, he just shouldn't have.
What do you think the fallout's going to be from all of this? The book coming out, Biden now having cancer. What's going to happen with the 2026 midterms? Is this going to hurt the Democratic Party?
Well, I can't imagine anything not hurting the Republican Party, given what's going on here. And I read this almost every day that the view of the Democratic Party now is the worst it's been in decades. Mm. And I'm saying, well, you know, I understand that. I could see that, you know, there was a lot of things that Biden did wrong, could have done better. He completely ignored the migrant problem in this country. I mean, clearly, when we saw governors of Texas and Florida taking migrants into their state and busing them into liberal Democratic cities, the country went crazy. Said, wow, I didn't know there was a migrant problem. And apparently neither did Joe Biden. And he said, well, we got something got to be done about this. I'm not absolving Trump for anything because he tried to stop any kind of deal that was going to be made so he could take care of it when he was president. But there were so many things that Biden could have done better and didn't. And it's still hurting the Democratic Party today. But if you look at what we've talked about for the last 45 minutes and the thought of people still voting Republican, because unless the Democrats don't have an alternative to this, I mean, just like Kamala Harris didn't really have an alternative to Joe Biden, if the Democrats in 2026 don't have an alternative to what they've had with Joe Biden, then they're in trouble. But I kind of think it's not going to last. I don't think it's going to carry on with into the elections.
That's what I was going to ask you. So if you leave being Ken Rudin the political junkie and you become Ken Rudin the political consultant, what names would you put forward for Democrats? Who do you see as the future leaders in the party that could change things?
Well, I mean, you know, there's so many of them. There's Gretchen Whitmer. There's Josh Shapiro. There's Pete Buttigieg. There's Wes Moore. There were so many of them. There's so many that I can't think of them now. But the whole list, I actually put a list on Facebook the other day. I think I had like 15 names on them. There were a lot of them. But you know something, will the country vote for a woman? I mean, we had two opportunities with Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris, and we failed. Does that hurt Gretchen Whitmer? I mean, I don't know if it does. Does the voting for Pete Buttigieg, does it rule him out because he's gay, given the fact that, you know, Donald Trump and the Republicans have been going, you know, nonstop assault on the LGBTQ community? So I don't know, but I think there are a lot of good leaders. Oh, gee, I can't believe I don't have the list in front of me, but there are a lot of them who are very, very impressive. And Josh Shapiro, you know who's not on my list is Gavin Newsom. There's something slick about him that I just don't like. And he has a new podcast where he's inviting right-wingers on to show that he could talk to right-wingers. But by doing so, he's giving right-wingers a voice. Andy Beshear of Kentucky is another name. I think J.B. Pritzker of Illinois. But Gavin Newsom is just something. I don't know if the country is ready for a California slick guy who's been having right-wingers on his podcast.
Well, and another, speaking of books, the former Biden press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, she announced that she's leaving the Democratic Party. And this comes ahead of a book she has coming out in the fall. What do you make of that?
You know, I rolled my eyes when I saw that. First of all, who is she? I mean, of course, I know she is, but who is she that she's leaving the Democratic Party? Now, her reasoning is laudable. I mean, she's leaving the Democratic Party because she feels, just like Jake Tapper feels in his book, that the Democratic Party abandoned Joe Biden, and she feels that's terrible to do it. But first of all, by leaving the Democratic Party, I can't see what her future is in the party. I don't know what her next job could be. And I don't think that's the right response. I think Joe Biden did deserve better, but I don't think people pushing to him to get out was the wrong way to go. And I think a lot of Democrats feel that had Joe Biden run, Donald Trump could have had, impenetrable majorities in the House and Senate. As it turned out, the Democrats won seats in the House in 2024, but they didn't get enough for a majority. And I don't think they would have done that with Joe Biden. So I admire her loyalty. I admire her devotion. But writing a book and saying, I'm leaving the Democratic Party, it's like
a stunt.
So what?
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about national politics with the host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. I wanted to take a few minutes just to turn to Ohio politics. After getting the Ohio Republican Party endorsement, frontrunner for governor Vivek Ramaswamy solidified his place in the 2026 governor's race. And his main Republican opponent, Ohio's Attorney General Dave Yost, has dropped out of the race. Now, this election is still a long way off. And the rumor is that Governor Mike DeWine is still trying to get Lieutenant Governor and former OSU football coach Jim Tressel to run. Any thoughts there on Ohio politics and the future of our governor's office?
It's shocking that these decisions, these Trump endorsements, the announcement by Yost to drop out of the race a year in advance is pretty remarkable. Usually, people start to get their thoughts together. At the end, I mean, I remember some great primaries in Ohio's history. I remember, 1970 with Robert Taft Jr. And Jim Rhodes for the Senate. I mean, it was just ugly and fascinating. But this was, as it was happening, it was the year and the month of the primary. This is a year and a half where they want things neat and tidy. And I know that the governor is not a big fan of Ramaswamy, and we'll see if anybody else could come in. But the Republican Party is not the way it was years ago. It is not a Rob Portman party. It's not a George Voinovich party. It's a Vance, Moreno, Ramaswamy party, and we'll just see what happens.
And then,
by the way, with only a few minutes left, can I just talk about two things coming out that we should pay attention to. One, the fact that Trump is having his parade on July 14th with, millions and millions of dollars, for his birthday party. I mean, that's just beyond belief that they're going to spend millions of dollars, especially with a administration that ostensibly is trying to save money.
I wonder what Elon Musk thinks of that parade.
Exactly. I would just wonder about that.
They better be all Teslas driving down the road.
That would be perfect. And also, it was interesting what Putin said to Trump this day. He said, well, something, what Ukraine did with the knocking out our planes, we're going to do retribution. We're going to respond. Russia has been slaughtering Ukrainians every single day. And the fact that Putin is suddenly stunned by that there was a response by Ukraine by destroying these planes. I mean, obviously, it was a big embarrassment for Putin because the thought was, and he probably is winning the war, but the opposition is not finished yet. And the fact that Ukraine was able to do this without the U.S. knowing it and without probably Trump tipping Putin off was kind of fun. So those two things kind of interest me, fascinate me.
We have about 2 minutes left, so I was going to ask you one more Ohio question. For the Democratic side, former Health Secretary Amy Acton is the only Democrat running at the moment, because it seems like everyone is waiting to see what former Ohio U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown is doing. Do you think that Brown should run for Senate again? Do you think he should run for governor, or do you think he should stay out of it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, first of all, I didn't think he would lose to Moreno last year's election. Mm-hmm. He's the only Democrat who I thought could win in the state. You know, there was Tim Ryan, there were others who ran, but seemed like that he was the only guy, Sherrod Brown was the only guy who could survive. But he's not the future. I mean, he was first elected to the Senate in what, 94? Or, oh no, I'm sorry, 2006, but he was in the House before that. Mm-hmm. He was, I think, Auditor General or something, statewide office. He's been around for decades. I don't know, he may be the only Democrat, and especially if Trump's numbers are really bad, because, you know, midterms usually punish the president in power. Maybe he's somebody who could win, but I don't know, is Amy Acton too liberal? She's talked about running before, but she always backed out. I don't know, I just don't think that the Democrats are in the good shape with a good bench that they could have had years ago. It's just remarkable to see the fall of the Democratic Party, not only in the U.S., but in Ohio as well. It was a swing state. I mean, Glenn and Metzenbaum were there forever, and the thought of Democratic senators is just inconceivable lately. Wow, just amazing how things change.
Yeah, not quite purple anymore in Ohio. But I want to thank our guest, Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.